Welcome to Conscious Communication, the podcast that can help you improve your company's culture and better your team's communication, helping you build more significant relationships. Now here's your host, Philip Bogolub.
I have the privilege and honor of talking with Jeffrey Madoff. He is the owner and founder of Madoff Productions. He's an adjunct professor. Everybody sit down for a while. There's a lot of stuff here. He's an executive producer, a playwright. He has over 50 years of life experience. He has degrees in philosophy and psychology. And he's got a new play that he has written and produced called Personality, which we're going to talk about, which will be premiere. Well, it already did a premiere once, right?
Yes, that's right.
So the unofficial premiere for me is in Chicago because I live in Chicago. So it's in the Studebaker Theater on June 14th. And it's called, like I said, Personality. We're going to talk about that. So it's very cool because I will definitely want to see that. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Philip.
We've had some discussions before we hit record, which is always enjoyable to talk to people and get to know them and not just hit the record button on its own. So one of the questions I ask at the beginning, before we go into everything, you know, all the stuff that I talked about, owner and founder of Madoff Productions and playwright, you know, a psychology degree and stuff. You didn't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to do this. What was the serendipities? What were the accidents, the coincidences that happened in your life that kind of said, okay, I want to go down this road. Oh, look at that. Well, I'll go that direction. Where did that happen for you?
Well, I had everything planned meticulously from birth.
Wow, cool. Tell me about it.
Yeah, and the accident was the pregnancy that resulted in me. I'm born. What am I going to do now? And I had a beautiful equivalent of a studio apartment inside my mother. And it was a nice place. And I lived there for about 9 months. And then I was ousted. And, you know, I was just hold on to there. Couldn't take anything with me. I was naked, vulnerable. And out into the world, I'm thinking, what the fuck? What happened? And there I was. So, you know, I had to make some decisions of what to do. And it was funny because as I, you know, tried to sort of move away, there was a cord. And I wasn't able, you know, to just go off on my own. So I learned both metaphorically and actually when that cord was cut, how to become independent and how to pursue the different things that I thought I might want to pursue. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, I wasn't thinking of going all the way back to birth, but I completely understand it. Was there any particular one thing that comes to mind that kept pushing you in where you're going with going to college for your degrees and being a producer and a playwright and all this stuff that you're an adjunct professor? Is there something that kind of, you know, a person that kind of influenced you or an incident or happening that said, oh, let me take this chance and see what happened, and it kind of sprung you in that direction?
Well, you know, when I was younger, I never thought of anything as taking a chance, really. You know, you just did stuff, you know, you know, being a parent myself, no, I realized that the main thing your parents first hope is that you don't somehow kill yourself, you know, as you're beginning to navigate the world.
Right.
Because great parents make you feel safe, make you feel loved, make you feel respected, and make you feel as if you have a voice. And I was fortunate that I have that with my parents. And so I was always just encouraged to do whatever it was that I enjoyed doing. And so my parents had retail stores in Akron, Ohio. I was always drawing. So they would bring home big sheets of, you know, craft paper that they wrap packages in for shipping. And I could draw and put it up on my wall, and I could do what I wanted to do. And I would write stories and, you know, do all this kind of stuff because ultimately I'm seduced by ideas. And I never thought about, oh, I could make money doing this. You know, so I'm really happy there are people that are podiatrists, but I would not want to be one. I'm really happy there are people that are accountants, but I would right. not want to be one.
Right.
And so, you know, I've always expressed and been encouraged by my parents, sometimes encouraged by their laughter when I could do things, you know, and, you know, it's always been a process for me without a real plan. Mm-hmm. And so I've aged, but I haven't matured all
that. That's good.
Yeah. And if you doubt that, you can talk to my wife. But but it's that exploration. And, you know, I think I was taught by example, not by being lectured to, where you don't learn anything from by being lectured to, is the exploration of ideas, of curiosity, of asking questions. So I've always been one who loves learning. I don't think there's any boring topics, but there's lots of boring teachers. So I tried not to be one of those. But then I had teachers who were great and who, you know, could light a fire and make me want to know about something. And so it's always been, even to this point in my life, it's always been that joy of discovery, the seduction of an idea, the curiosity to want to explore something. And along with that, and I'm talking to someone who plays multiple instruments and is working on their own musical, a compelling need to express.
Yeah, everything you're saying, because I was blessed with great parents also, and a grandmother, my dad's mom, and they're all gone now, but they're always living inside my head. It's one of those mm-hmm. things that my parents and my daughter, my wife, my grandma always called me Philly, and I was like, go ahead, try it, do it. And it was, you know, because when I graduated high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. My dad said, you got 1 year. I'll help you. But figure after a year, you're out on your own. I joined bands. I wrote music. I took some jobs. You tried to figure out what I want to do in my life. And you don't always know, even at my ripe old age, I'm still not sure all the time, because I like opening this. You talk about ideas. Opening up ideas is I've got a note here on another question, but I'll say it. Napoleon Hill said it starts with a thought, just a thought, you know, from the book Think and Grow Rich. And it is true. Albert Einstein used to say imagination is just a preview of coming attractions. And the thing that you, when you say talk to your wife about, you know, the mind is still a kid, and you don't want to lose that imagination. Once you lose that imagination, you lose the fire. Not saying it's bad, but when, you know, you're born to like 3 or 4, you're just playing with pots and pans. I played with my Matchbox cars. And, you know, you have these all of these imaginational thoughts and everything. And then suddenly it goes away because they say, pay attention. I'm not knocking it. You need to learn certain things. But it kind of takes a back road to it. And sometimes if you kind of get into that whole thought of, what am I imagining? What am I dreaming about when I'm sleeping? What am I thinking about out of what I'm doing for whatever my work is? Maybe that's pointing you into the direction that you should be going. And that's why I was asking you, what influenced it? And because it's really important in the conscious community world to question yourself. Don't go your whole life and then go, I wanted to be a whatever, and then you never tried it. Even if you got a little bit of it, even if you did a little bit of it, it's something you could say for yourself that you felt good. It makes you feel good going to sleep at night. So I want to go into what you've written a book, and it's based on some of your classes, and it's called Making a Living with Your Ideas. What? Tell me more about that, because obviously you're doing it. I'm doing it. You've been doing it longer than I have. I came from the corporate world to come to where I'm at now. But get more into that. Making a living with your ideas. Expand on that a bit.
Well, I teach a course at Parsons School for Design in New York City called Creative Careers, Making a Living with Your Ideas. And the idea behind it is to deconstruct different professions in the creative world. And that begins with defining what creativity is. Because, you know, a lot of people disqualify themselves right off the bat, saying, "Oh, I'm not creative. You know, I'm very left brain. I'm not creative, and you know, I'm not right brain, which is the spatial." And first of all, that's not even true. That mythology of split brain theory started with Roger Sperry back in the 60s. He did a number of experiments with the two hemispheres of the brain, seeing what real estate in your brain was, speech and whatever. And he never intended it. He won the Nobel Prize for his work, but he never intended it to be defining personality traits like creativity. It wasn't about that. In the 90s, late 80s, heading into the 90s, brain imaging got much more sophisticated. What was realized was there's lots and lots of crosstalk that goes between the two hemispheres of the brain, and that you can't tell by looking at the activity what's creative and what isn't creative and all of that. But if you Google left brain, right brain, you know, there's all kinds of bullshit quizzes you can take online and all kinds of articles and so on that build on that false premise, basically, that you're either left-brained, which is, you know, organized, or right-brained, I'm saying it very generally,
right,
more creative. And that's just not the case. But it also gives people an opportunity to disqualify themselves. I'm not creative. Or, you know, I'm good at business, but I'm not creative. Or, you know, I'm really creative and I can't do business. Picasso was very creative. He was a very smart businessman. Walt Disney was very creative. He was a very smart businessman.
Exactly.
You know, so there's all these mythologies that go along with creativity that I think it's important to look into and dispel, because I strongly believe that you do not say no to yourself. There's going to be enough people out there trying, mostly from their own agendas and their own insecurities, to try to dissuade you from taking chances and taking risks. And I'm not talking about risks like, you know, jumping off Half Dome in a flight suit in the middle of the night because the thrill of soaring is really good until you hit a tree and get killed.
Right.
But I'm talking about whether it's playing music like you do, or writing or painting or dance or whatever it is, that exploration. Because I think, you know, to me, it's fulfilling to do these things. And fulfillment is a huge part of what I seek when I do work. And the creative careers aspect of it is it's kind of happened that as my life has unfolded, unraveled, or whatever the hell, is that, you know, facing those challenges of how do I make a living doing what I'm doing? Because I don't want to do something that supports my work. I'm not my work, which is also my play in both the literal and figurative sense, to support me.
Right.
So I've been fortunate that I've always figured out ways to make a living with my ideas. So I started as a fashion designer. That was out of nowhere. There was no basis for that. I didn't know anything about it. Starting a production company and teaching myself how to direct, edit, shoot, light, all of those things. Teaching, then doing this play, it was desire and that compelling need, as I mentioned, to express is what fueled all that. The curiosity fueled all that. The discovery fueled all that. And that is fulfilling. And I've been fortunate that I could figure out ways to support myself doing what I love doing. And that involves risk.
Yeah.
But the biggest risk to me is, as you get older, feeling unfulfilled in your life and regretting that you never took the chances to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. Just for a second, talking to my conscious community, is listen to what he said. He trusted his gut. Didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but he had a visual, something visual in his mind, whether it was a written word or images, or we'll talk about the musical / play in a second. He had the stuff inside him, but he didn't know what to do with how to get it out. And you also have to have a supportive family and friends. You have to have a what they call a mastermind group, fancy name. It's people that are supporting for you. because there's some people that are out there that their only mission is to bring you down. They was like, you can't do that. You've never done that before. What are you talking about? You don't know anything about the fashion industry, because I went on your website and looked at all the videos, and I'm like, wow, this stuff is right on. I'm sure when you started this stuff, and I think that's what's important for people to understand, is this is not just going to happen overnight all the time. This takes time. It's like watering. You got an empty part of your lawn, and it's got no grass. It's dead. There's nothing. And you put some seed in it, you water it. Well, it might take a couple of seasons to get a full head of grass, but maybe it'll die and you got to do it again. You know, and it's like, you know, you want to water it, keep watering your dreams, keep watering your ideas. But I can totally see, and I've been doing this for about 7.5 years now. I mean, I come from the corporate world. You were mentioning MRs and all that stuff. I was an X-ray tube engineer for many, many years, and traveled the world supporting CT scanners and X-ray machines. And I thought I would just stay there, retire. I was happy, made a nice living. I was thrilled. It was always something in the back of my mind. And, I mean, he could see everything in the back here, but I've got a guitar that's, let's see, 50 years old, and I still have it. And it's an Epiphone. And I have some old electronic pianos, actually, one of them controlled by floppy disk. It still works. And I kept it, but I just put it aside because, of course, it's my mother's fault. Because when I played her music, she said, "Why don't you go out there and get a piece of paper?" I said, "What the heck is a piece of paper? Just in case it doesn't work." So I got my engineering degree, got my MBA, and I've got no complaints. I had a great life. But when those little nudges came and said, "Guess what? Company's changing. You don't like it. You know, you got to follow that." Or if you don't follow it, to your point, then you just get to the point in age in life, you're like, "I never did that. I just never took that chance. I never took that." So that's great lead-in, of course, into, I love the name of the book, Making a Living with Your Ideas, by the way. So creativity and imagination, and you just kind of talked about it a little bit. Can you go a little bit more into, I know you talked about it, but I want to go further into, because you're debunking false understandings. And that left side, right side, you know, when you take degrees, you always have to take a psychology degree. You've got it. I do not. But I took one of those classes, and I found that always interesting because it's very stamped. If you do this, you're that way. That's it. You can't do anything else. And I don't like that because it just puts us in that category. And if you tell your mind that enough, eventually you're just going to believe it. So how do you debunk some of that stuff? Where do you start from? And saying that, you know, you want to be a book writer, you want to be a professor, you want to write a musical. How do you debunk that stuff in your mind, which is constantly telling you, no, you can't, you've never done that. What are you taught? You did a little bit of that 20 years ago, but you can't do it. How do you kind of put that aside and put the positive side up and go forward with it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you're asking a very big question. Because you mentioned, you know, coming from a positive place in terms of one's expression. There are also people who are compelling creators, be they writers, filmmakers, or whatever. They come from a very dark place, and they're able to use that darkness to propel their work. They're able to use anger to propel their work because they were told they couldn't do things. And that being told no fueled them, and they wanted to prove people wrong. I never had that anger component, fortunately, because I think it's healthier for the other relationships in my life. But there are many different ways that people are compelled and express their creativity and different sources of it. And I think what happens very young can happen from parents, it can happen from teachers, it can happen from kids that are mirroring their parents' attitudes, where when you put your ideas out there, you're at risk. All of a sudden, you're vulnerable in front of another group. And how you cope with that has a huge impact on your life. And most people are discouraged from taking those risks because that vulnerability hurts. somebody takes a swipe at you, you know, you've got to be pretty anchored to not have that knock you off balance. I wasn't conscious of it when I was younger. You know, looking back, we all construct narratives about our lives that help it make sense. But I didn't, you know this stuff. I couldn't have told you when I was younger that I feel I'm more fueled from a positive place than a negative place. But both can net phenomenal work. Both can net amazing things. Neither is better than the other in terms of the outcome of the work. It may be in terms of your life.
Right.
One thing, that pain can lead to addiction. That pain can lead to isolation. That pain can lead to a lot of things. And it can also lead to stunning work.
Right.
But I'm happy that I'm happy.
Yeah.
I'm happy that I'm happy. And that when there would be people that would make negative comments about the stuff I did, that didn't dissuade me. And I think one of the reasons is that my parents made me feel respected and safe and encouraged me through that. It wasn't through a conscious way they brought me up. It's just the kind of people they were. And I was very, very fortunate. And my wife and I have done the same with our kids. You know, because you have to discover who your kids are, you know, and allow them to be. You offer their safety and guidance, but it's really important, and you have kids, I know, it's really important to realize your kids aren't you.
No.
They're not going to replicate your life. And if you can celebrate who they are and just be there for protection and validation and love and support, that can do a lot to help you overcome problems later in life. And, you know, I was fortunate enough that I wasn't as vulnerable to the kind of, you know, body blows you inevitably get when you put your own work out there. So I forget what the question was. But hope that answered.
Well, it's about creativity and imagination. How do you define it and debunk the stuff that keeps you back? You already did. You already did. And your point is well taken. And I didn't think about it that way, because all that creativity comes from negative and positive, you know, on, off, light, day, you know, all that's, it's always two ways. And sometimes it comes out in a positive way or a negative way, but yeah, you know, you don't know, even somebody that's positive can have addiction. So it's, you know, it's, there's all sorts of different things. When you're talking about negative reactions. So my philosophy called Ajinoy, like we talked about before I hit record, was my first one. I got a bunch of email addresses. And the next morning, and I'm on a high, right? I'm thinking, oh, people are interacting after it was just an hour, but they stayed for like a half an hour. We had talking and people were asking questions and hitting up. I'm like, I'm empowering other people. The first thing in the morning, I see a negative response. And it was just kind of like a flushing of your whole body. And I have life experience, but when I was at work, working in the corporate world, it bothered me a little bit because I always took pride in my work. That's the way I was raised. But now you're hitting me at my core. And I read it two or three times, told my wife, and she goes, okay, you had 22 or 23 people. Yeah. One person responded. Yeah. And that's what you're going to focus on. You know, and you need that. You need that encouragement, because I knew that in my mind. But my emotional self is going, everybody's going to love me. And I know it's not true. I mean, just like with your musical, everybody's not going to like it. That's okay. It's not supposed to be that way. Everybody's not going to like what everybody does. There's just, you have a niche or a niche, whichever fancy word you want to use. And you find it and you hone it and you work on it. And if you selectively find positive people to support you, tell you when, you know what? Jeffrey, okay. I think it's great, but how about try this? But if they're doing it genuinely by not going, you know what, how about, I mean, you've got this musical / play. You had to collaborate. You had to do things. You had to give things up going, wait a minute, that's not what I had in mind. But you didn't lose the center of the what it was molded and shaped to be, but there were some things that enhanced it. But you're like, oh, I didn't think that. You have to be open to that just as well as you have for, quote, criticism. And I don't think it's criticism, because I started picking, in the philosophy, one of the things we do is ask, what am I supposed to learn from this? What am I supposed to get out of this? One of the first things. And I learned that, oh, well, she didn't like this. Let me take a look at that. Let me see if that's, maybe she's right. Maybe from her point of view, this is, you know, and I improve something. So instead of taking it out and saying, oh, woe is me, this, oh my, you know, all focusing on one person, I retransform that into something going, how can I make it better? Maybe I should look at this a little bit more. So that goes into, we talked a little bit about this with business, entrepreneurs. And we've kind of glanced on a lot of the stuff, or not glanced, but talked about it a little bit. Not easy, but it's well worth the time and energy. It's a roller coaster ride. And when people say, you know, wow, you did this, oh, you're an instant success. Yeah, it took me 10 years to get there or whatever. From my point of view, I want to know your point of view on this. There's, you know, we're talking about labels and stuff with psychology, physiology, psychology and social work. And I'm not knocking it. This is all good stuff, but they have labels and things that you can or cannot do, right, left side of the brain. One of the things I read many years ago when I was doing my business degree is like, don't enjoy the process, only enjoy the end result. I'm like, yeah, all right, so if I'm doing that, then the product's going to really suck at the end. So do you view it as enjoy? I think from my philosophy of life is enjoy the process, because when you get there, it's like a degree in your life. Is this, okay, I got my psychology. Is this all I got? I did a lot of studying and took a lot of tests, gave up a lot of stuff, and this is all it is? So I want to enjoy that route and learn from it. Do you feel the same way, or is it something a little bit different, being an entrepreneur and just in general?
Well, I place a very high premium on enjoying the process. I think that I say that I'm fortunate, but in truth, I work very hard to get fortunate. I'm fortunate in that I try, and I'm usually successful at surrounding myself with really good people. And that collaborative process, which is huge in theater. Now, there are people who just don't like collaborating. Those are megalomaniacs,
right?
Often, but you know, there are people that for whatever reasons during their upbringing and whatever happened to them have to act out on the job.
Right.
You know, and we've all seen that, whether it's negative bosses or coworkers that, you know, always put their agenda over everybody else's and don't listen and whatever. But one of the things that I say, whether it's my film production group when we're doing something, same in theater when I meet the cast and everybody for the first time, is don't ever let anybody rob the joy of the process, because the process is what it's all about. You know, that final result, it's great to feel good about what you've done and what you've accomplished, but the joy is in getting there.
Yes.
And then when it's done, it's great when other people, you know, appreciate it or like what you do and all of that kind of thing. But I'm all about, all right, what's next? That was cool. I'm on another journey. You know, what's next? And that's what's important to me. And, you know, I think that, again, from a young age, people are discouraged oftentimes. Because also the parents, there's no reversal for being a parent.
No.
You know, you're a parent and, you know, the goal is that you don't screw up your kids too badly, you know, and I think that it's really important to be sensitive to that, because in a sense, your coworkers are not your kids, but they are people that want to be heard. They are people that want to be acknowledged. And so open communication builds relationships. Listening builds relationships, whether that's familial or with friends or on the job. And that collaboration, that communication, to me, is what results in the joy in the process. Because when people feel safe they will try more radical things.
Yes.
That can be more fulfilling. In the play, my director, Sheldon Apps, is fantastic. And we have a wonderfully constructive collaboration, which does not mean we agree all the time. But when we disagree, it's with respect. It's with openness. Because what we know, and this is what's essential to a good collaboration, listening, and that you share the same goal. We want to put the best piece of entertainment in front of that audience. So how do we do that? So there are some people that will give you criticism because basically they want to write their own play and haven't. And so they will say things, you know, that are more about what they would do if they were writing it. And my attitude is, well, then go write your own play.
Right.
You know, I don't need to hear that part.
Right.
If you're getting the same note from a lot of different people, then you should pay attention to it because
right.
something's not communicated. You know, you can't write a funny line that you think is funny. It goes in front of the audience, and after two or three audiences, it falls flat all the time. You know, there's real easy proof whether something is funny. The audience laughs or they don't. And if they don't, you got to figure out why. Or you just edit out that joke because it didn't work, you know? And I'll give you an example. Do people call you Philip or Phil, by the way?
Either one.
So here's an example, Phil, which was, to me, fantastic collaboration with the director, Sheldon Apps. We did a table read, which is what you do when the first time you gather all the actors together. It's literally sit around the table. Everybody reads their parts, and you're hearing everybody's voice, and you know, you're just beginning the exploration and getting familiar with each other. And there was a scene that I wrote when Lloyd Price, the main character, goes to Australia for the first time, and he gets high for the first time. Actually, in his case, the first and only time. And as the actors are reading it, they're cracking up. They're all laughing. And I wrote it. I wanted it to be funny. They're laughing. That was good. Something wasn't right. And I wasn't sure what that was. And when we finished the scene, and I said to Sheldon, what did you think of the Australia scene? And he said, well, it's funny. We know that. Everybody was laughing. It's interesting. But is it essential? And I said, what do you mean, is it essential? And he said, does it either reveal more about the character or moves the plot forward? I said, no. I said, that it's not essential. And boom, there went 4.5 pages out. And by the way, I had no problem doing that.
Right.
Because what I have found, at least this is my own reaction, when I get, and I prefer to call it a note rather than a criticism, when I get a note and it makes sense, because a lot of people who are giving you notes or suggestions are trying to be helpful. But, you know, whenever you hear something that's not totally aligned with how you perceive something, people consider it criticism. And I think that that's another negative that you don't want to look at because, you know, you're all working together, set a common goal that you're trying to achieve. And so it was no problem for me to take it out because when I hear a note that resonates like his did, I was really looking for confirmation in my own doubt about it. You know, and I knew something wasn't working. And that's the part that wasn't working because what it ultimately did was cut down the velocity of the story and the writing. And so, yeah, it was funny. It had some good jokes and all that kind of thing. But it wasn't essential to the story.
Right.
So the more you pare it down, whether you're composing a piece of music, whether you are framing a photograph or painting, whether you're doing movement in dance, the more economical you get the more you stick to the essence of what moves the narrative forward that you're trying to express, the better. And it's going to be a better piece of work as a result. So I think that that's really important. And that comes through collaboration, listening, and being open. I don't listen to everybody. There's people that, you know, make comments about things that they don't resonate at all. And that's not the plan, right?
Right.
But there are those things that when they do, it's really clear because I actually feel it. And I feel it because I'm open to it, but not everybody's opinion's valuable.
Right.
You know, you also want to talk to people that you trust and you know they know what they're talking about.
Yes. And, you know, it's very important. You were talking about listening. And when you were talking—
I'm sorry, what did you say?
You were talking about listening.
Oh, I didn't hear it.
Sorry about that. I could have—
That was a joke. That was a joke.
It went right past me. I'm in Chicago. It's already Indiana right now, or Iowa. That was good. It was smooth, too. I didn't even see it coming. But listening is so important. I don't learn from talking. I learn from listening. And it is a skill. When I was younger, I was not a good listener. Not a good listener because I was— and I think most people are like that. They're looking like they're listening, but they're only listening to get a break in what you're saying so they can give you an answer, what they think is going to be the answer, but they didn't listen to anything else after that. So it's a skill. And in a play, a musical, art, whatever you're doing, it's what they want to hear, not what you want always to hear. You know, and writing that way, so there's a couple songs. I mean, you're much further ahead than I am in the process. I mean, I've got it done and everything, but it's not gone anywhere right now. And somebody did listen to it and said something about one song. And I was like, oh, well, thank you for sharing. And said, well, you know, good luck with everything. Great, great idea, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. So I listened to it. And then I took a couple of days and didn't listen to anything. And I went back to the song. Like, I see what he's saying. It didn't fit. There is just a little twist. But I talked to a friend of mine and said, don't change anything. I said, why? Well, because you're not even there yet. You know, keep it the way it is. And when you get to that point where somebody's wanting to buy it and collaborate with you and come out in a production, say, let's do this. This is fantastic. Then you could do something. Because I was a few people listened to it. Somebody said, how are you for collaboration? I said, start now. I only want to make it better. Those that claim to be the wise men are sure the fool. I don't know everything. I don't have those experiences. And somebody who might be a better writer or write a different song and take, because I wrote all the music. Does that mean that every single song has to be written by me? No. You know, the ego was going, well, this is mine. Everything's going to be, well, then fine, but you're never going to get it out there. So you got to have that leeway. You don't want to lose the core of what you're writing and what you're creating, but you have to be it. You have to be open to that. I like the idea. You say it as a note rather than a criticism. I like that. I'm stealing that, by the way. I like that a lot.
It's a gift. You don't have to steal.
I'm sorry?
It's a gift. You don't
have to steal. Thank you. It's not trademarked? Okay, good. But I'm definitely going to use it because it's, you know, negativity is always something where, and there is something to be when you're older. Because you have those different life experiences that when you're 40, 50, 60, whatever your age is, that you didn't have when you were 25. You had nothing in your life. You had nothing to compare it to. And as you get older and you go through different experiences with your family, your friends, and just losing jobs or just life, you have that chance to learn from it. And you really don't realize how much you've learned until you get to that point. So it's very cool that you actually have this play in this musical that's coming out. And the collaboration, how do you find, for me, it's very difficult to find people to collaborate with. I'm just not talking about the music. I'm talking about people to interview, real people, to have a conversation. And I understand it's not supposed to be easy, but how do you distinguish that when the difference between somebody who is part of that mastermind group, somebody who's that collaborator, somebody who's there to support you, and if it turns negative, because I'm assuming that's happened to you. You know, you think somebody's really positive and they're doing something along the way and suddenly it goes, I'm like, Where did that come from? And then it just kind of degrades. And you're trying to work with that person, but it's getting worse. And I'm not one for screaming, yelling, and swearing, and I don't do that. That's when I was younger, probably, but I really don't do that much. I don't do that at all anymore. And not like I did tons of it anyway when I was younger, but I try to be able to gently say in some kind of way, you know, this has been great. We've really learned a lot. I really appreciate it, but I have to move on, however you say it. But how do you know when that it's the right group? How do you create that? You know, what I know what you're looking for. It took, I don't know, how long did it take you from written word and idea? But oh, you're already in the business, so you probably knew a lot of people, so that might not be a fair question. How long did it take you from that written completed word of going, okay, now I got to get it out there? And how did you know who you were going to trust? How did you know who you were going to collaborate with? How did you figure out where to go? Because there's a lot of people that are, they say they have stuff, but they don't have anything.
Well, you find good people through other good people.
Oh.
And so I had no reputation in the theater world, but I did have friends who were in theater. And so I would ask them. And then when I was interviewing directors, I trusted my instincts in terms of who I liked and who I thought I could work well with, which fortunately has worked out wonderfully with this director, Sheldon. But, you know, I would do that with cinematographers doing my film work. I would meet people and talk to them and get a real sense of what their sensibility was. And at the same time, getting a sense of what kind of person they are. Now, throughout my history, I've got a pretty high batting average in terms of filtering out people who turn out to be toxic. But I've had those. I've had a few people, not many, for as long as I've been doing this, very, very few, because I do trust my instincts. And you talk about knowing your core. You really have to know your core before you can know whether anybody's violating.
You know? That's a good point. Yeah.
And so if you're kind of squishy in what your point of view is and what you're doing, you're more easily buffeted around because you're not sure yourself. So you first of all have to be sure yourself. That doesn't mean that you don't change. That doesn't mean that you're not open to new ideas and new perspectives. But it gives you a sense of whether or not it's going to be a good fit with that other person. So that's a critical part. And I wanted to augment what you said when you said that you learn by listening, you don't learn by talking. You do learn by talking. A lot of people are verbal processors, and they talk, and as they are processing, they do it verbally, and they will talk about what it is. And if they are listening to themselves, they will discover things that they hadn't thought of before. And, you know, if you've ever been in therapy, a good therapist doesn't tell you what you ought to be doing or should be doing. They allow you to hear your own voice. Because the main thing in any of these expressions we're talking about and in life is getting out of your own way.
Yes.
And that's really critical. So you can learn from talking, but you need to listen to yourself talking as opposed to blabbering. You need to listen to yourself, and instead of defending your ideas, you know, you don't need to defend your ideas. And if you get, again, going back to the word that you like, which is, you know, word used in theaters, the notes, you know, you get clarity from that, because you're not everybody's criticism or note is valuable. Sometimes it's just their opinion, but then you have to determine which do you value more. That opinion, is there something you can use from it? Or you know what your intent is, you just have to make sure that your intent is landing. Because you may have intent, but that may not land on the audience, so you got to rethink it. And again, I think it bears repeating, if you're hearing the same thing from a number of different people, no matter how much you love it, something's not working. So you got to take that in too.
I agree. And very, very well describing that, you know, I didn't think about that because in my home, I've talked to probably 100,000 people and in my basement, in my studio, I've talked to them over and over again. And when I did my first presentation, my first lecture, I told them, I said, I talked to everybody in here like thousands of times, if not more. And I talked to myself all the time. Quick little story. When I first got into the company, the manufacturing company I worked for many years, I didn't realize I was talking to myself because I came from field engineering. I was the engineer that fixed the equipment and I was usually the only one there. So I talked to myself the whole time because there was no one there. And I had no idea. So my boss called me into his office. He goes, Phil, just joking around. He goes, oh, you know, something I just want to make you aware of. You know, how should I say this? You need to shut up. I'm like, what? what are you talking? Goes, and he did it with a smile. He goes, I don't think you realize how much you talk to yourself. I go, okay. And he said people were, they weren't complaining, but saying he not only talks to himself, but he does it really loud. Because I was in an office. I was never in an office. So we laughed about it. He goes, just be aware of it. And I walked outside the door, closed his office, went to my desk. I said, out loud, I said, talking to myself. I'm like, oh, for crying out loud. And you know, it is important that you have that conversation. You talk about wishy-washy. When I started down this road about 7 years ago or so, it was new. In the business that I was in, I was doing it my whole life. So I was used to it. I knew, could spot somebody with this personality, that inflection, that body language, all that stuff, especially on the phone or whatever. And I dealt with people all over the world. And I'm like, well, I'll apply that to what I'm doing now. No, I didn't have that emotional factor. I wasn't emotionally, I did, it was personal for me, but not that emotionally where it was in your core. So this one relationship, it started out really well and went right into the toilet. And I was, now that you're mentioning it, I was wishy-washy. I was just starting out. I wasn't firm with my ideas. This person was helping me create some things and thought this was good and that was good. And I had no idea, but you're absolutely right. You hit on that and it was more of a blabbering that you were referring to it was wishy-washy. It was not a good internal conversation with then in the mind comes out physically through the words, but you're also right 100% that there's times that when I went to a hospital and the machine was down for a week and the engineer is being screamed at, there's an old Yiddish word my mom used to say. She took Yiddish school when she was a kid. She said, "Vermach de moil," and means shut your mouth. And I always had that in my mind because my mom got mad at me. She'd go, "Vermach de moil." I'm like, okay, I better stop. And I learned that in my mind that when I went there, this person was really stressed out. This person was at edge because everybody's, why isn't this working? This thing's been down for a week. Da, 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 da. Let's go get a cup of coffee. And I knew, again, this is experience in life, that person had the knowing of what was wrong more than I did. I was only there because they think I'm going to save. I never, most of the time, I didn't do anything. I was there as a support mechanism. I was there, not a bull in a china shop. I wasn't running around smacking things. Oh, look at me. I know everything. And from those experiences, it's helped me. I still make mistakes. My grandma lived to 99. She said, the last time you stop making mistakes is when you're 6 feet under the ground. You're always learning. And that wishy-washy thing is, it's interesting. So, all right, you just had me learn something and I don't really appreciate it. No, but it's very true. And I love those stories and how you're collaborating. And I'm looking forward to different things that people are doing with for what I'm doing. And I definitely want to go see your show. Tell me about your play Personality. I want to hear more about it.
Personality, the Lloyd Price musical, is about Lloyd Price. And Lloyd Price is someone that you might not know his name, but you know his music. I'll give you a quick example and apologize in advance for my singing. Because you've got walk a personality, talk a personality.
That was him?
That's him. And Stagger Lee and Laudie Miss Claudie. And Lloyd was one of the cornerstone figures of the birth of rock and roll. And Lloyd is black. and his life unfolded at the crossroads of the civil rights movement, the youth movement, and the birth of rock and roll.
Oi.
His first song, Lottie Miss Claudie, he recorded when he was 17, and it was the first song by a teenager that sold over a million records.
I had no idea.
So what's, see, and nobody does. He's an unsung hero. He's amazing. And what this, the success of Lottie Miss Claudie did was it shattered the wall that was called Race Records. Because up until that time, if you were buying a record by a black artist, you had to usually go to a black record store. It was called Race Music.
Okay.
And I mean, that's, you know, just crazy. And nobody is prejudiced against Green. And so the fact that it sold so astoundingly well, because records, the music business was an adult business. Up until that time, teenagers didn't buy records.
Oh.
And, you know, a record player is a big piece of furniture.
Right.
And an interesting piece of trivia, you know why they're called record albums?
No.
It would probably be your great grandparents, so you may have never met them. The record player was a big piece of furniture, and they were 78 RPM, so they're like that.
Oh, no, I remember those. Oh, yeah.
And so if you got a symphony or something, it might be six records in a binder, an album. And that's why they're called record album.
Oh, interesting. I love
stuff like that.
Okay.
I love stuff like that. And so Lloyd not only shattered that wall called Race Records, which wasn't his intent, by the way. You know, he didn't know. He was just this kid who caught on. Right place, right time, right ingredients, everything going on. But then he was the first musician of any color to start his own record label. So he was an entrepreneur. He was the first black person to own the nightclub below Harlem Theater across the street from the Ed Sullivan Theater. That was where the Colbert Show is now, actually. So Lloyd's life was fascinating. And when the Lloyd character steps on stage in the opening number, he says, "My mama wasn't a whore. My daddy didn't leave. I didn't learn how to sing in church, and I never did drugs. I want to get that shit out of the way up front." So there's none of the tropes that dog those kinds of stories.
Right.
And Lloyd was an amazing guy. I met him through a friend. He and Lloyd, this is how stuff really happens. He and Lloyd met in the waiting room. They went to the same eye doctor. And they got to be friendly, just striking up a conversation as they were waiting. And this guy, John Bonanni, was the executive producer at Radio City Music Hall in New York. And he had hired me. I did their 75th anniversary film. It was part of the Christmas Spectacular. And he and I became friends. And called me up and he said, "Do you know who Lloyd Price is?" I said, "Well, Mr. Personality. I know his music. I don't know anything about him." And he said, "Well, I told him about you." I said, "How'd that happen?" He said, "We go to the same eye doctor." And he said, "I think you two ought to meet. And, you know, I want to do a documentary about him." So he wanted to raise his profile. They thought there could be something there. Lloyd and I met. We hit it off immediately. I started to research him so I could do an intelligent interview with him for the documentary. And it was getting to know him. I thought, wow, why didn't I know any of this stuff? I love music. I love the music of that era. How come I don't know this stuff? I don't know any of this. And it was an amazing story. Well, that's been the reaction of everybody that's seen it. I didn't know that guy. I love his music. I had no idea who the guy is.
Right.
And that evolved into me saying to Lloyd, after the documentary was done and he really liked it, he said, "Look, I want to tell your story. I think I can capture your voice. And your story needs to be told. It's an important story. You're an unsung hero." And he nodded his head. And I said, "I'll write the first few scenes and you'll see what you think." And I did. and he loved it. And then I said to him, there's something you need to realize if we're going to work together. And he said, what's that? And I said, your story is bigger than you are. You were a transformative character. And he goes, Jeff, I've been waiting years for somebody to say that to me instead of blowing smoke up my ass. And so we bonded over that because Lloyd had a phrase, the truth needs no defense. And so when the story isn't all roses or the moonbeams, you know, it's there's some rough stuff in there. The racism he faced, but also, you know, his failed marriage and things like that, where he was okay with not looking good. Which is really important. And it not only is important dramatically for a good story, it's important in terms of trying to be authentic and tell the truth. And that's what we did. So it's got great music. I get to say something else when I'm talking about the play is I was on the conference call with Lloyd Price and Little Richard.
Oh, so cool.
Lloyd got Little Richard his first recording contract.
Oh, very cool.
And actually, the second act opens up with Tutti Frutti. And the phone call was on. It was Lloyd was saying, you know, Richard, I need you to talk to your label because we want to use Tutti Frutti, you know, in the play. And Lloyd and I became very, very close friends. And he is an amazing person. You know, you talked earlier on when we were starting about how does stuff start? I have no idea. Because if not for that serendipitous meeting and a friend that called me and me being curious, well, yeah, God, I see how they did Dagger Lee and personality and Lottie was caught. Yeah, that'd be cool to meet him. Right. Yeah, that would be fun. Did I know that that would be truly a life-transforming event, that I would become so passionate about wanting to tell his story and write this play and take on what's a very heavy lift? I had no idea. And it's been an incredible journey. And, you know, Lloyd unfortunately died in May of 21, but he did see the table read. He saw the 29 hour, which is when you actually have the actors for 29 hours of both rehearsal and however many performances you can do. So you rehearse for 2 days and do two performances, hopefully to attract backers. And then we did a workshop and he saw that, but he never saw the full up production.
But he did see the general idea of it.
Oh yeah. He saw the play all the way
through. Beautiful.
And what was so cool, Phil, was when we did the 29 hour, we did it at the Jerry Orbach Theater in New York. And it's about 120 seat theater, something like that. But I said, Lloyd, at the end, the actor who plays you is going to say, ladies and gentlemen, the real Lloyd Price. And so you'll go up on stage and you say, what should I say? And I said, man, you're the consummate showman. Flash your 1,000-watt smile and say whatever you want.
Right.
And we were seated next to each other. And during the finale, and by the way, 29 hour is very informal, meaning there's no sets, there's no lighting cues, there's no costumes, there's no props, there's none of that. And when you have a scene, you come up and you put your script on a music stand because you're not what's called off book. You're reading from the script. But I was able to assemble a fantastic team of people. And as the finale number is happening, I look at him, the tears are just streaming down his cheek.
Oh, wow.
And they call him up on the stage and he goes up there and he could not talk. He was so overcome and it's just got his 1,000-watt smile and he's waving.
That was it. That's good enough.
And he's coming up the aisle. And I go out and I hug him and his body is just quaking and he's weeping. And he said, Jeff, I just saw my whole motherfucking life unfold in front of me. And knowing that it had that impact on him was not only so fulfilling to me, I knew that we had created something really special.
Wow.
And I'll tell you, mounting a play is no easy feat. Raising the money is no easy feat. There are so many moving parts. And the interesting thing about a play, unlike doing films, is that a play is live every time you perform it. So there's the possibility for change every time you do it. Where a film is locked. Once you've filmed it,
you're done.
That film is it, and whoever sees it over the next 100 years are going to see the same film.
Right.
A play is always subject to a reinterpretation, even with the same cast on another night, because stuff happens.
Yeah.
But I love that because the performers in any live performance, and it's also true in sports, which is why I think sports has such a hold on people. I don't know if anybody's looked at it this way. But you're vulnerable in a live performance. You're vulnerable all the time. If you go up on a line, which means if you forget a line, you better hope you're on stage with a really good performer who could help you recover quickly so the audience doesn't notice.
Got it.
You're playing football, you can get hurt.
Right.
You know, you're giving a concert, something can screw up. In film, you can stop and say, let's do another take. Can't do that in a live performance.
No.
So it's really interesting because I think that sense of risk informs not only the performers, but in an interesting way, it affects the audience and how they receive what you're doing.
Interesting. That I've got nothing to say. That was just an amazing story. You're directly connected with somebody that you respected and somebody you learned. And go back to the conscious community audience. Did you hear what he said? He had no idea it was going to turn out that way. You know, some eye doctor knows somebody else. These weird serendipitous, these accidents. And like, you know, but you have to be open to it. And, you know, just going down that road and suddenly going, oh, I'll try this. I've never done this. I'll try this. I never did this. And look what you're doing now with it. It's quite an amazing story. So everybody take a look at it. Has anybody actually talked to you about it? Or can you even say that they might be turning that into a film?
I haven't explored that yet. You know, my very first thought when I started, because I'm a filmmaker,
right?
I thought I would do that. But then I thought, you know, when I see a great play, a great live performance, there's an emotional impact, which there are times I've had it with film.
Right.
But it's different when you're having a live performance. And I wanted to people, my hope is that the audience will feel like I have felt when I have seen something that really touches me, that makes you laugh and makes you cry, and that you care about what's happening to the characters, you care about the story. And so I wanted to do it as a play.
That's cool.
I hope at some point we do it as a film, but right now all concentration.
That's not your focus. I definitely want to go see this, especially since it's really easy and I'm only a few, like 25 miles away from the city. So thank you for sharing all that stuff. I mean, we could go on for a long time. We're going to have you back again, if that's all right, because I just love talking with you and obviously on a very similar frequency with stuff. And it was two lessons. I was blabbering and a wishy-washy. So I learned from stuff. One thing I would like to end with is something positive from yourself, some aphorism, a thought to leave with the audience for whatever it is, whether it's your dream or something to focus on or something in your mind, something that you feel that you can leave with and a positive note they can think about. You're talking about with your musical. You know, people are gonna get emotional. People are gonna see things in themselves. That's the best thing. That's the one thing that, and it, like you said, it's not always film sometimes does that. But a lot of times when you're seeing something and you feel that chill and you're like, whoa, I just saw something, you know? And so something positive, something on an upbeat note or something that you could pass on to people that might help them go, oh, I didn't think of it that way. That'll help me. Go ahead.
Number one, I would say stay curious. Stay curious because curiosity is the fuel that propels creativity forward. You're always trying to solve a problem, solve a mystery, do something that helps you achieve something else, whether it's greater insight, whether it's emotional impact. Stay curious and feed your curiosity through discovery. And what that means is see films, see plays. You ever seen ballet? If you haven't, go see ballet. You ever been to a classical music concert? Then go to one if you haven't. Go to museums. See things that you didn't even think you'd be interested in. Be open to the experience of discovering something new, because that'll have an impact on you. It'll have an impact on your work. So be a lifelong learner and listen. And that can't be emphasized enough. Listen to what other people say in a gallery. Listen to how things affect people. And keep your mind open all the time, because curiosity and discovery can lead to creative fulfillment.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you. That was wonderful, because the first thing that came to mind when you're saying being curious, and if I didn't, in my corporate life, if I didn't go to a trip overseas, and everyone was in overseas, this happened many years ago, my boss goes, "You want to go to Holland?" I said, "Michigan?" I go, "No, you idiot, overseas." And if I didn't do that on my own, and I mean, the corporate office was there too, but I did it all on my own. I never traveled overseas like that. You know, I went to, you know, like in a, you know, to Barbados, not Barbados, you know, some vacation island or whatever. That's not being on your own. And if I didn't do that, I wouldn't have realized how much it pushed my confidence in myself that I could do that. It's not so scary. And then you do the next one and going, oh, I have to go to Germany. I have to go to wherever. I'm like, oh, I could do that. You know, and being open, because when I always traveled, whether it was in the US or overseas, I didn't eat the Subway sandwiches. I ate their food there. That was me. I knew some people, oh, no, I'm not going to try that. I'm like, well, I don't care if it stinks, but I'm going to try it. And you know what? I fell in love with most of the food, because when you go to certain countries and you're eating it here, that's not the same food. So, and again, you go to other states, whether it's a southern state or East Coast, West Coast, center of the country, it doesn't matter. If they got something different, if I didn't open myself up to grits, I didn't know how much I loved them. I mean, you know, with cheese and butter and, you know, not in the hotel, that ruined it for me. But when somebody said, no, let me get, we'll go to a real place that has grits. I'm like, oh my God. Now I don't say I eat it all the time, but it's always my breakfast thing. And my wife makes like some kind of grit thing. So keep yourself open, keep yourself curious. I love that. And Jeffrey, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. It's been absolutely wonderful, and I would love to invite you back on if that's okay with you sometime in the future.
It's been my pleasure, and I'd love to come back on.
Thank you very much. And I'm always going to say this at the end. It says, remember, it is more important to express your thinking thoughts and not the thoughts you are thinking. That is what is called conscious communication. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Conscious Communication. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and recommend on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcast. You can also get more great information at ConsciousCommunicationPodcast.com.